everyone, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast. I'm your host, Oz Balabanian. This is the podcast about the science and design of virtual reality. And today with me is a special guest, Stefano Baldassi, who is the Senior Director of Analytics and Neuroscience at Meta, which is the augmented reality company. Hello, Stefano. How are you doing?
Hi. Hello. I'm very good. How are you?
Quite well. And of course, our usual co-host, Peter Leckhoff, coming in from Germany.
Yeah. Hello. 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 Hello.
Stefano, this has been a long time coming. You are probably one of the first people I met in the industry back in like 2015, 2016 in the bowels of Boost VC. Do you remember that at all?
Yes.
Testing session?
I remember that. Yes. That was a long time ago, even for me, because time expands as you're in this field. Like a month seems like a year. This is augmented time, if you wish.
Ooh, that's probably a topic we might get into. Back then, you handed me a business card and you were like, Meta glasses, you know, you should check this out. I was like, I'm surprised I hadn't heard about this. And I looked into it. And I think within the next couple of weeks, there was a big announcement about the Meta 2. And it made a huge new rebranding of the company. And that Meron, you know, became a figure from then on. So that was definitely fascinating. And you guys have been one of the bigger names in the field driving for this augmented reality HMDs. When did you initially join the company?
Oh, that is a fun story, because I joined the company in March 2014. And that was very new to me, more than probably it was new to you when we met about a year later. I actually was a visiting researcher, visiting faculty at Stanford. And I was almost on my way back to Italy, to my main university where I was tenured. And in the Italian newspaper that I was checking in the morning, along with the sport Italian newspaper, as you may imagine, there was a little like corner reporting the Forbes 30 under 30. And I just, out of curiosity, I was checking the list just to figure out if there's, you know, people from the Valley, because, and I was in Stanford, and, you know, you expect that 30 under 30 in tech come from the area. And there was this guy, this Meron Gribetz guy, and there was an explanation of the product as, you know, see-through wearable gesture-controlled system. And that was very attractive to me for a number of research reasons from my past research. And I said, okay, I'm going to have to get in touch with that guy. So I sent him an email. In 2 days, I was in the Mansion House, which is the iconic original headquarters of Meta. And the day after, I was asked to give a talk that happened to be my job talk. And in a few weeks, I was an advisor, academic advisor, but that with a Series A locked in became a position that dropped me out of academia. So that was a very serendipitous, like, you know, sliding windows type of story.
It's a very success story, right?
So I guess you've kind of mentioned this. You're an academic. You have a PhD in perception. Perhaps you can kind of guide us through a little bit of your background. What is a perception degree entail?
My background starts before being a perception scientist, because I became a perception scientist because I want to be the national Italian team coach for the volleyball team. And this is a passion that I started like having as a coach since like late years of high school. I was already making a living coaching. I'm a short guy, so how do I excel in volleyball? Yes, by coaching. That was my rationale back then. But importantly, volleyball is an incredible sport in terms of how human performance is driven in a very short time. Decision-making, the use of the motor system, the use of space around you, the social skills and the social skills that are needed to interact with your actions with others. It's not better than any other sport, but for sure it requires fast, even social decisions that happens in less than a second. Otherwise, the ball goes down. So that primed me to study neuroscience instead of studying motor science, for example, to excel as a coach. So my drive for human performance is the original drive. Then I started studying neuroscience. And of course, the passion for science took over my passion for volleyball. And this is how I went to study perception, because a lot of our actions, daily life, are driven by perceptual decisions, and perceptual decisions translate into motor actions. So I developed a career of that, academic career. I did international, I was in labs around the world. I started before my PhD in London. And then I took my PhD in Italy in an international lab. My boss and supervisor is a famous Australian scientist. And I did my postdoc in San Francisco before becoming tenured in Italy. And then my last appointment was this visiting scholarship at Stanford in the neurodevelopment lab of Professor Norcia. This passion for performance and perceptually driven performance is at the base of my passion for augmented reality. And when I transformed myself from a basic scientist to an applied scientist in augmented reality, I figured that the product, the core of the augmented reality product, should be driven by a deep understanding of human performance.
And how was it to transition from academia into the business world? And I'm asking this because I kind of did a similar thing, and I got a lot of questions from researchers I meet during, you know, the IEEE VR, the VRSTs, that basically ask, how does it feel? How does it is to sell your soul and to basically, you know, just go into this, you know, economical nightmare from the passion-driven science?
Yeah, the sell your soul is fun, and I'll tell you why in a second. But this is a typical question, and it's a great question in a way. I kept drafting other people from academia after I went to that. I would tell you this is a personal answer. Because to me, that was a revelation. I should have gone into product research when I was 25, not when I was 45. But I did late, and there's zero regret because my personality is a good fit with the fast, iterative, agile research methodology versus, you know, the long 2 years old, 2 years like long grant submission to research completion cycle. And all the uncertainties that leak over very long time, because if you fail your grant, you're going to have 6 months to apply to the next. Meanwhile, you go pretty much random and you get bored. There's no shortage of stimulation in applied research. Plus, we're in a space that is still a research-based space. Augmented and virtual reality are still heavily driven by research and fundamental research. So I'll tell you, even as a almost 15 years old tenured academic, I think that the research challenges that I've been going through in AR in these 4+ years have gone well beyond the challenges that I had in basic research. Plus, I have the satisfaction of seeing my research translated into something very tangible. That goes in the hands of like customers and users. And that is a big satisfaction. But this is a personality fit. Not everybody would share the same passion that I have for product-based research that I discovered late in my professional career. And this is even when I interview people from my team, I learn to try to extract this aspect more than other aspects of their skill set, because this personality fit translates into, you know, a culture in applied research for AR, which is a very, very interesting space.
I see. And coming to the applied research and to what you're doing, maybe you could elaborate very briefly what your team is doing and how it is performed. But before that, I have a short question. Are you literally sitting right now in the Meta office?
I am.
And this kind of big meeting space in the office in the middle of it, right?
There is quite a lot of space in the headquarters of Meta now, even for big meetings.
Yeah, I think I think I've been to this office actually myself and was showing the software the company I'm working for is doing. So I'm like looking at this feed and remembering how we glue with duct tape lighthouses to the windows behind you. But yeah, so coming closer to, you know, what your team is doing in the applied research. So what is your everyday job and what is your team doing?
Yeah, let's start from the last. My everyday job is to coordinate my team with all the different departments of Meta, because my team handles basically all the research at Meta, the, let's call it user science in general at Meta, plus all the robust data that we are increasingly accumulating through our system. So we do analytics and we do a lot of research. We do a lot of product research across the stack, meaning from the hardware development and the hardware components, including, for example, the study of optical engines, the characterization of the optical engines, the sensors behavior and the sensor specs. So we participate to product requirements specs through research. We do research even in the hardware ergonomic. Interestingly, I'm a vision scientist by deep expertise, but I'm the first name in the patent of the industrial design ergonomics of Meta 2, because the study that I co-led with the industrial designer on the head of people made Meta 2 probably one of the most comfortable headsets available there, and independent reporters have, like, there is an article by The Verge about it. It's a relative assessment, because all these headsets are very heavy and on absolute terms relative and not very comfortable, yet Meta can sit in people's head for hours. Now we know that 3-4 hours of a session and people can wear it and do their development without major problems or headaches or anything like that. So this is a matter of pride. So going back to the research we do, then for the we move to the software and computer vision team. We do a lot of characterization even of computer vision algorithms, those that require perceptual characterizations. What I mean, for example, motion to photo latency, which is an aspect that Meta 2 improved a lot along the pathway from the earliest SDKs, 2.2, 2.3, to 2.7, you can the users can observe major improvements. And we have helped characterizing that and deciding, you know, whether or not to ship it based on the data we collected, doing a lot of psychophysical studies, for example. And then we go to the interaction part of things, in which we collaborate with the UX and design team and the hands Cortec team, for example, to keep developing and interfacing the Cortec to the interaction design part. So we also do prototyping. And as a last important aspect of our team, I have data analysts who crunch all the data, both the functional data, the analytics that we collect, and we create KPIs and metrics that drive our future development. We are a small company, and we are in a highly competitive market of giants. We have shipped a unit, so we need to extract as much information as we can, and our department is very pivotal to that. And act on that information, of course. So part of my daily job is also to translate the data that we crunch internally into actions for all the departments of Meta.
So what are the some of the factors that go into that? It sounds like you're getting data from all departments of your company, and because you have a background in research and data analytics, you're trying to make sense of what everyone is feeding you, and so that you can put together what people call actionable items. Can you talk a little bit about that? What are the certain things that you have made that you've gotten data from and you've realized that, no, we need to make changes perhaps in the ergonomics or the headset, or you mentioned the motion to photon latency, and perhaps there's a range that's more acceptable with augmented reality than there is with virtual reality. Are there things you can pull from your background?
Yeah, that's I can tell you about more recent studies. But I want to make a small point on your question. We don't get data from other departments. We create data for other departments. And then we also analyze those data. So meaning we help all the departments to collect the best possible data for the questions they have. and also collectively as a company, like for the product team, for example. So we define the methodologies, the techniques, and we also collect the data. So we own the entire pipeline from a data-driven question to the suggestion to action for the department. And we have an internal model that is based on what we call it right now, RAS, Research as a Service. So we basically sell research services to all the departments. This is not the only possible model. We're trying to get into more hybrid and more product-like focused model, but this is how we act. So to your point, what are our contribution? I'll tell you one. It's a paper that my collaborator of my team, Moshi Antian, she's a PhD in neuroscience from Stanford. And she has presented today, I guess. I'm a little offset with jet lag, just coming back from Asia. And I think she presented that today in Florida at the Vision Science Society meeting, which is the top human vision science conference in the world. A poster that shows what are the real drive to eye fatigue. We know that one of the big pushes for the AR and VR world is to solve the vergence accommodation conflict. The vergence accommodation conflict is the fact that, you know, the eyes, they behave in particular way to be able to perceive different depth in a natural image. And in a natural world, accommodation, which is the process of changing the curvature of the lens of the eye to focus at particular distances in the world. And the process of vergence, which is the convergence of the two eye in a way that the two eyes point both to the object of interest in the world, they go together. So we verge where we accommodate and the other way around. And this is a process that is violated in 3D technology, including 3D movies, in which there is a unique focal plane that the customer, the user, needs to focus on in order to perceive the rendered image. But vergence is driven by delivering two slightly offset images to the two eye, offset in the horizontal plane in X. This association between accommodation and vergence has been an obsession of the AR and VR industry because it was told, and there is an extensive literature, especially, for example, by the Berkeley team, the incredibly productive Berkeley group of Marie Banks in the School of Optometry. They did incredible research showing that when you dissociate accommodation and vergence, that's basically an increased fatigue of the eye, and the user perceived that as a pain. We have shown in our research that was presented today in Florida that, yes, vergence accommodation can cause eye fatigue, but there are causes of eye fatigue that overrule by a long shot vergence accommodation. For example, if we modulate the distance at which the eye needs to read, if you read very close versus reading at a mid-distance or at a far distance, this is a stronger drive to eye fatigue than vergence accommodation. So we were able to dissociate the fatigue that was induced by vergence only by the fatigue that's induced by vergence and accommodation, and vergence only dominates by a long shot. And this is an interesting data, especially given the fact that one of the leaders of the industry, Magic Leap, that all of us are very curious to see in the world soon, has made one of these biggest points, differentiating point in solving the vergence accommodation conflict. So this is a result. This is a research result, almost basic research result that we have generated. Vergence accommodation is important because it's important that real objects and virtual objects are focused on at the same distance. So this is a big win. But in terms of fatigue, this is not the major problem, even because in AR, people reaccommodate to virtual and real targets all the time. So that fatigue never really is never really experienced by a user during a normal session of augmented reality. So this is an example, but we have a lot of examples that go from the characterization of perception as a function of the visual field, for example. This is another interesting result. The presence of a wider visual field makes that perception better than in small visual fields. Small visual fields create depth perception and depth estimates biases, and sensitivity is lower. And this is interesting, and this is a winning point of Meta. I just mentioned a winning point of Magic Leap, but Meta 2 has a field of view that is almost twice as much as the second largest that we know of. And we know that is helping a lot the contextualization of the virtual content, of the augmented content in the real world. And there is an increased accuracy in depth just for the fact of having a larger.
So let me ask you a question. Did I understand correctly that what you at Meta are doing is basically providing the data for decisions, how the future headsets or the headsets that you already built are made? So let's say it's a company, when I come and build an AR headset, I can say, okay, I really want to have a very wide field of view, or I really want to have, you know, like Magic Leap, this magical technology, or I'm really eager on this tracking part. And you basically provide the data that helps to choose what is necessarily in the first place and what to focus in the beginning on.
That's absolutely correct. This is exactly it. And that is a mixture of short-term research, but also long-term research and research programs that extend to longer threads. And the example, I cannot talk much about what we're looking into the future, but I can talk about what we did in the past. In order to get that visual field that we have in Meta, we went through probably 12 to 14, according to the definition, different iterations of the optical engine. And we studied each one of them individually. And during that process, we also refined the way to study that. Now we can master the techniques to characterize an optical engine. But in order to get that and to get the best stereo region, the best rendering in the presence of a large visual field, we had to do a lot of iterations. And there was a close collaboration with the optics team, of course, that created, you know, I would say a pretty solid optical engine like the one we have.
Can you explain what that means? What is an optical engine? Is it the hardware and software stacked together to produce a virtual object?
In Meta, the definition of optical engine is the specific combination of a display and its like mechanical arrangement in the headset along with the visor. Okay, our specific optical engine is characterized by a number of geometrical and optical relationships between the display and the visor. And those are, of course, modeled and studied by the optics team and then characterized extensively in human by us. So the optical engine is the specific is the compound between the display and the visor, the optics that shoot the render, and its geometrical relationship. You know, any other detail is a little more confidential too.
No, sure. But why did you or maybe I missed it, but do you have some kind of blogs or publications where you basically describe your work? Because as a consumer, I would imagine if I come across materials that basically shows me scientifically that a company has decided to do certain things and it's good, I might be more open to getting your product compared to any of your competitors who usually also seem like to be very startup driven. Oh, we just do it because we can company. So it seems like there is a lot of thoughts and considerations. And I just wonder if there is a way for an average consumer to, you know, come across them.
This is a very good question. Competitive landscape like the one we are right now, those type of data get to the very core of the IP of the company, right? So for as much as our instinct as researchers is that of publishing results, our first drive should be that of creating IP And we are creating IP through our data. In terms of publications, yes, there will be publications. And we did a couple of publications at Meta for ESMART 2015 and ESMART 2016. The first of which shows also how we go after methodologically some of the problems using psychophysical techniques, for example. But we have to make sure with our legal team that those data are no longer used to create, core IP. We released our data in different forms, but there is a relatively long delay between the use of the data and the publication of the data. So there will be more publications in the future. And this, for example, this result that we presented today at the Vision Science Society in Florida, that is something that our legal team validated as, that can go out. But there is probably, this is the tip of an iceberg of like 10%. We can give 10% of our data, but 90% are proprietary data.
Besides the public papers that are put out, is there any sort of consensus or any sort of a consensus amongst like the researchers that work at these major companies at let's say Magic Leap, at HoloLens team, at Google, Facebook, and even Apple at this point? Is there any sort of shared knowledge base of like these are the problems that we're trying to tackle, and these are perhaps certain approaches to solving those problems?
This is does a that go great, against? Yeah, this is a great point. And in terms of my specific scientific domain, this is starting to happen right now. Last year, let me refer to the Vision Science Society meeting, which is a meeting that I participated to the first because I'm an old fellow in the field, to the first ever, because it was a branch of a larger ophthalmology conference. And now it's been there for about 20 years. And the last 2 years, I started seeing applied studies by researchers that were basic researchers in our field. And now they work in the companies, in the companies that you mentioned. The best consensus came in a beach bar last year in Florida. In which we gather with Magic Leap, Oculus Research, Microsoft, and Apple researchers, as far as I think I mentioned all of them, and us from Meta. And we had a good time. And the more we drank beer, the more we were trying to steal each other's secret. But we were all very good at protecting them. And it was a very fun encounter. Yes, there are. We know that this field, the field of research that we come from, is can provide fundamental insights, not just useful, but really core insights to the development of these technologies that are still AR and maybe a little less VR, but AR has a long way ahead for the technology, core technology development, and now the user is going to eventually use when we left light. The quoted strip of glass that Meron is often talking about that each one of us will wear in the future. There is a long way, this long way will be accompanied by a lot of research.
Mao, speaking of research, so in one of our previous episodes, we talked about how augmented reality relies on the device itself, understanding the world around it. And so far we have been, because it's your background, being very focused on the visual part of the headset itself, but maybe we could do a small dive in. What else needs to happen from research perspective in order for augmented reality to actually reach the everyday person's space?
Research. Yeah, we do vision science and we do a lot of other like human science. But then to your question, research needs to go all around the clock from core technology. And by core technology, I probably mean mostly optics. All the computer vision techniques that enable interactions and the use of sensors. So also the systems research. What is the optimal? So we have to go to the core of the individual sensors that we're using and how we're using them, defining the specs of the sensor for making that the ultimate machine. For example, what is the resolution that an infrared sensor that detecting like RGBD camera needs to have in order for all the interaction to be supported like freely. Let's say we have like perfect interaction, 26 degrees of freedom, hands interaction. Still, what is the, how many pixel do I have to have in my finger for that interaction to be? What is the optimal temporal resolution? And also, because the research in that goes beyond the use, what is the power that these different components can afford in a fully wearable small headset? So there's a lot of advancement in like even batteries, for example.
Yes, sure. Maybe one example is hand tracking. I've been talking to a company that does hand tracking and has been multiple times on our podcast, and they were a little bit sad that you do this magical AR device, but you're trying to build your own hand tracking instead of using their technology. Now, obviously, that's their interest, their technology is used, and I'm not, you know, defending them, but I always wondered, is it maybe a little bit too much for one company? And I have the same doubts actually about Magic Leap, and trust them even less because they're not so open as you. Is it for a company too much to build optics, to build a headset, to build an ecosystem, to build a world tracking capabilities, artificial intelligence that understands the world, and also in addition to that, this precise hand tracking? So is it maybe a better idea to just rely on certain things that other companies have already built and focus on the visual part? So what is the motivation that at Meta you're trying to solve all those problems? And maybe it's good and maybe you're going to solve them the best way, but for me it looks like a very big chunk of problems that you're trying to face from every possible direction.
This is a great point. It's a great question and a very legitimate question. And the answer is complex. And it's not even definite answer because company strategy is transforming as we move on. But Meta is, as a vision, Meta is a strongly vision-driven company. And if you think about what we accomplished, and Meta 2 was designed by a company that was half the size of the current company, which were like, we were about 100 and under plus people. And I have to feel very proud of what we accomplished across the stack, given the size of the team and the resources we had. But that tells something, that we are a strongly vision-driven company. And that carries, you know, a strong willingness to do the Meta way. And the Meta way, for example, for hand interactions is something that is driven by our neuroscience message of using the hands co-located to the objects, because we know that the brain works very well with objects that are around the hands versus dissociation of special dissociation of hands to object and more arbitrary gestures. So we would like to create a system of interactions that are driven by this vision and concepts, right? Now, for that to happen, the roadmap is long, and the road is bumpy. We know that we have to expose more features to the hand right now, but all the development that we're doing right now is going to lead us at some point there. What we're trying to, then we get to the company strategy. The company strategy is something that we have set right now, and as every other company has a degree of flexibility. But we are talking a lot to our customers now. This is another point that we have, and it's also research that we're doing. We're doing customer research, and I'm at the center of that part as well. And talking a lot with them about what they need next, given what we have right now. And our iterations are strongly driven by even one-on-one conversation with our customers, who are developers, who are technically savvy people and can give us, like you guys, we can get in a session and dissect all the aspects of the product, and we will value the feedback as technical feedback per se, and also as technical feedback as applied to the use case that we would like to promote the most.
So when we received here at the office where I'm sitting the Meta 2 and we opened the box, I have to say the box was beautiful. The device is very gorgeous. It looks really, really, really great. So everything regards how it was built, how the box was filled, and it was like a few weeks or months ago, whatever. It was really good. But then we started to the developing process, and first time we started with it, it felt kind of, okay, the SDK is kind of still raw. But now I've seen during the past weeks and months a huge development in that SDK, and more features are coming to it. And is that a byproduct of you talking to the customers after they receive the devices and you basically reacting to it and shaping it in a way that supports them?
Yes, absolutely. We need to do that. This is an effect, and this is a mechanism that's even the size of our company makes that a need for us. But it's also an advantage because we're talking to real customer, real developers in AR. We're not just brainstorming internally on what the features should be or talking theoretically with a potential customer, with a lead, and defining the product to that. We're talking to users that are having even lots of pain with our product. But those pain, as you can see, for example, SLAM. I mentioned an interaction. But our SLAM, I had a report from a customer that I was interviewing because I do also that last week, who in Europe, and he told me with SDK 2.7, I can say that your tracking is at the level of other commercially available product, which wasn't the case before, right? So based on a different type of feedback that we get, we prioritize and iterate on basically the pain points of the product. And the SDK is improved. The support that we give is improved. We've got asked a lot to provide, for example, example code, example apps, and we're improving a lot on that. So we're making the life of the developer easier and gathering information from the developer because we're building this product together as much as we're building the vision together, because even our guidelines are based on collaboration and communication with our base.
Yes. So would you say that the statement I'm going to say right now is more or less true? So when we look at the whole landscape, and there are those huge giants like Microsoft, who I have mixed experience with, so their headset, they shipped it, it's expensive, but it's sometimes hard to talk to them. Then you have Magic Leap, who have like a lot of funding, they have a lot of open job positions for researchers, but it's very hard to talk to them. So on the one hand, they're kind of doing something there, and who knows what they're doing, but you cannot really look at it. And would you say that at Meta, the big advantage and also something that might give you the big advantage is you're not blown up, but very specific and very user-oriented design of the product and the SDK? Is that what the Meta and corporate DNA basically incorporates and would, you know, from your perspective and so from the perspective of the company, is going to lead to the success? Or
I don't want to make comparative statements. What I can tell you is that, yes, you got the point. The point is, yes, we ship. That's in our core DNA. We want to ship and be lean about it, and be facing the potential problems, but also the good feedback, because we have, you know, we're focusing on pain points, but we have a lot of good feedback on many aspects. So and this must be our DNA, and we're relying on this a lot, and I'm pretty comfortable with this. It's a David versus Goliath thing, and just as a personal twist, I like, you know, to support underdogs in a way. And in this business, as you mentioned, Microsoft and a multi-billion funded company, we are definitely the underdogs.
If we can go back to hardware for a moment, at the current moment, actually, Display Week is happening, which is a conference for all this display technology and very, very research-focused conference. What do you see that's just perhaps not attainable yet in a commercial sense, but just right around the corner that interests you and that you see would make a huge difference for augmented reality? And perhaps we don't have to be speculative or even, you know, talking about Meta specifically, but what is interesting you as a researcher, as a vision scientist?
You mean in terms of display technology development? What interests me is what is not there yet. I've seen a lot of research done by laboratories and even some companies in, for example, in the multifocal business or light field business. I don't I think I've seen a lot of limitations of the existing technology. So what interests me is what is not there yet, I'll tell you. So I would like to keep inspecting, going around and talking to researchers. I just came back from a very valuable trip, and I gave an invited talk at the Korean Advanced Institute of Science and Technology, KAIST, in Daejeon in South Korea. And I've seen a great effort by researchers in this, you know, MIT of Korea, in many aspects of core technology, including optical development. And I should go more in depth to like the research of all the labs around the world in this, because I think that the inspiring sparkle is still to be seen around. Okay. And if it's there, you know, it's still not fully understood by the tech. So it's my dream is has to be developed yet. That's has to be seen. Yeah, my dream optical system, especially to support what we have to aim towards, which is something that we wear like our eyeglasses right now, right? And we know that Google did something like that, some exploration.
Well.
There's some even, you know, big, I can talk about that because I'm Italian, but there's some big company involved in spectacle making, like leaders, world leaders, that had presence at AWE, for example. And I'm curious, what are they after? And there's still a long way to go. There's going to be a lot of surprises yet on the road to everybody wearing that. And I have no doubt that in a number of years, we will all have some form of wearable AR.
Have you seen the headline that Upload had, I think, a few hours ago, right, about the latest Oculus varifocal headset prototype?
No, I haven't
seen it. Is it something that goes... So from what I understand, they kind of have now prototypes that they show at some meeting where the lenses basically can move forward and backward. And
oh, yeah, that's...
Would this be something that goes in the direction of your vision?
That's a known technology, yes. This movable optics based on an eye tracker. Is that something that is close to my final vision? I'm not sure it is because I'm aware of some limitations of this to scale it to a product. There is a point, and this is what my research also taught me a lot, that in order to make a scalable product that eventually would be a consumer product, will replace our consumer mobile devices, every bit of the technology needs to be scalable to every user. And we know as human scientists and human researchers that individual differences have an incredible impact, right? So this technology, for example, I can just guess because I haven't seen the report from Upload VR, should be driven by some form of eye tracking. And there are many challenges to scale the ability of an eye tracker to read accurately the focal plane of individual users.
Yes. And here I have a question. What do you think about electrodes measuring your muscle activity in the eye? Because I've seen a few years ago in the University of San Diego a study or a prototype where they basically had placed multiple electrodes around the eyes and trained the machine learning algorithm to not only detect where you're looking from the signal, but also the depths of field you're actually looking at. And I think Samsung has also some kind of startup that they have on the side which tried to do eye tracking with electrodes. So would this give a better result than the typical optical tracking? Or
EOG is, we know that it's a very low-hanging fruit technology in general. And I am not directly aware of the ability to read binocular vergence plane accurately. The limitation that I see with EOG, but there's, you know, I'm open to every evolution of the form factor in the future, and is the fact that consumers probably will have a relatively hard time unless we deliver an incredible value to have too many like electrodes placed on our forehead But God knows what, because even, you know, I lived at a time that had, that in which cell phones didn't exist. And I, actually, I was a child when phones had a cord. Then cell phones didn't exist. And then they started like showing up. They were in cases. And then there was a convergence towards like late 90s, beginning of 2000, of cell phones to be as small as my AirPods case. The smaller, the better. So everybody was happy about it. And now, because of the value we get out of them, I have an iPhone 7 Plus in my hand, which is a huge device. And I'm happy with it because, you know, I'm a presbyopic guy because I'm old and you know, I need a big screen and everything else. And smartphones started delivering a value that traded off abundantly against the form factor. So God knows what, you know, AR is going to deliver that people will accept.
But do you think same will happen to AR headsets in a way who have certain trends like smaller and smaller headsets? At some point, people will say, actually, yes, smaller headsets are great, but I need better battery life, or, you know, better vision, field of view, whatever. So do you think that there will be also those trends happening in the AR landscape?
Oh, that's non-linearities in consumer adoption curves all over the place, no matter what, you know, the simple explanation of consumer behavior is. Yes, why not? I mean, I don't have a crystal ball here, but your prediction can well be the case. You know, we had like headphones, same thing. Now, you know, it's socially acceptable that we go on with our big headphones. I remember when I was a professor in Italy and I was commuting from Pisa to Florence with my big headphone, but that was the mid, like 2004, 2005, people were looking at me like a crazy guy. And that wouldn't be the case anymore today, right? And also that was not very appropriate for a professor, like to go around with that, but I didn't care much about it.
Yeah, I think the point you're making is very clear where, yeah, going from over the ear headphones to the earphones were supposed to be something that was totally not noticeable. And if I remember when I was growing up, I would run the earphones cable through my shirt. Yes. So that you wouldn't, you know, it would be as stealthy as possible. And we've gone to the point that with Apple like headphones and now EarPods, the white, the very visible nature of it is the thing that makes it a very attractive product. And perhaps even with AR, right? Like our vision is with contact lenses or something that is not very noticeable and blocking your eyes. But maybe with a company like Luxottica producing these brand glasses, you know, that is a statement that you would be making as a consumer by accessorizing yourself with a certain brand of glasses so that people can know your social status.
Look at the spectacles, right? I mean, they look very silly, but people were literally standing in a queue to get them and were like not even having a Snapchat account, but just running around with spectacles and feeling super awesome.
Did you guys know there's a second version of the spectacles that have launched that I heard I read one article about and have not heard a single thing since?
It was on Verge and somehow it's dying because Snapchat itself seems to not, you know, get traction off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but consumer adoption is a difficult thing. And
yes.
I mean, what's about with the fact that when we look at virtual reality and also augmented reality and any type of in between those, what usually a lot of people think about is embodied cognition. So the body plays a role. But when I think about augmented reality, I usually kind of always am skeptical of just saying that it's about the body. But I think it's more about the embedded cognition. So that the cognition is embedded in the real world and the embedded cognition is basically going further the externalist line just from the body. So the mind is not just a mixture of my brain and my body, but my mind and the way how I think. So the way how my thoughts formed, where I was growing up and how I think right now. Like I'm looking around literally while I'm speaking in between moving my hand, but also looking at objects around me, trying to grasp an idea, right? This is basically that the external world is through the embedded cognition defining how I think and how I perform things. And is it something that if augmented reality's main values that I see personally is this ability to place things around me and actually interact with them is going to be the main point that augmented reality is good. Is it something that customers are going to accept? Like, is it very, very intuitional for them? Or is it like, in my very scientific perception, always just, you know, my philosophy of mind background, because I had some courses, and usually consumers don't care. They just want convenience. And how do you deal with a product that you build with such diverse view of different perspectives?
This is a very deep point that you make. And so I think, yes, that is the value of AR. First, I absolutely agree with you, which is expanding the limits of our, in a way, even of our purpose, how we perceive the space around us, how we set the limits of our very personal space and the extra personal space. And we know that the brain is ready to accept modulations of that, meaning there are expansions of the measurable peripersonal space. And maybe I should define what peripersonal space is. But let me, okay, I'm wrapping up. I'm going one step back. The way humans interpret space and react to space is in two main layers. We know that there are patients with brain injuries that are very good at performing tasks within their reach, but they are not able to understand and react to space, to objects that are outside of their reach. So our arm length defines a very tangible neurological space, because it's also true the other way around. There are patients that are very good with stuff that are outside of the reachable space, but they completely messed up with interacting with objects in their within reach space and their body. They completely mess up. And there are many cases in literature, in the neurological and neuropsychological literature around that. When everybody will have augmentational space around, this space can be modulated, as much as we know from research that the presence of significant others can expand the peripersonal space to some shared social space, for example. There are very interesting studies in the neuroscience literature about that. What is an augmented space doing to our... with the augmentational space and functional augmentation, because we can use the tools that will be within our reach, what is happening to the way we perceive space? This is going to be a very interesting, even philosophy of mind question. Absolutely. I talk a little bit about that even in my TEDx talk. Now, the point is how consumers going to adopt that. It's a guess. It's just, you know, let's say an educated guess, but still a guess. I think there will be an implicit adoption if the content will be delivered properly. And then we go from the philosophy of mind probably to some ethics consideration too, because what we're going to augment the space around us with? Are we going to create a disjoint parallel world, and this is more like a danger of the entertainment use case, or what sort of tools are we deploying around us? How are we going to use those tools? Because we go back to our gesture system. We want to be able to use our body in an analogic way, but still we may use tools. AR give us powers. What are the limitations, and what is going to be perturbing our human nature in a way, and what is going to be preserving and augmenting in a more natural way our skills? Because AR will have a big potential to expanding our skills if used properly.
Absolutely. But there is also, you mentioned this as an ethical problem. I was trying to convince one of your competitors on this weekend in the VR SciFest to sign a memorandum, because I was talking to a sustainability researcher, and at some point my brain clicked and I was thinking, okay, there's actually danger to augmented reality. You could just remove certain parts of the world you don't want to see, or you can actually trick someone into believing something is happening. And I was trying to convince one of the competitors, you know, sign this memorandum that says don't do evil with augmented reality. But I think there is another realm that I just realized by listening to you. Yeah, there is a certain type of people living in dense forests that don't have a cognitive concept of depth. So when you show them pictures of a cow, and the cow is close by or far by, they think that the cow that is far away in the mountains is literally smaller. So because their whole world is this forest, and they live in an environment where they never see things that are far away, they didn't even actually develop cognitive concepts for this. And when we speak about augmented reality, it kind of fits into this transhumanism realm where, you know, those people living in this forest by the environment didn't get a chance to develop certain cognitive abilities. Someone who lives in New York and all the time sees, you know, the skyscrapers has. And if we add technology on top of that, like, you know, augmented reality glasses are not cheap, so certain type of population will have it and certain not. So we divide it even further. And if those augmented reality headsets, particularly with children, I think it's will be more important for young users who might develop certain cognitive abilities that will be transhuman in compared to someone who has not used this technology. So is this also an ethical consideration?
This is absolutely an ethical consideration. An ethical consideration will have to come. So what are the dangers of augmented reality? That's your question. And interestingly, this is a question that it's approached by many different, like, even governmental agencies. We have recently written a paper that will come out soon with Franziska Rosner, who's MIT 35 under 35, as probably the world leading scientist, academic scientist in computer security, who got this MIT 35 under 35 for her computer security studies in AR, and Tadayoshi Kono from University of Washington. Those are two professors at University of Washington. They collaborated with me and Moshe Antian from my team to start exploring what are the dangers of AR. And interestingly, a computer security attack in AR can be a brain hack. Okay, it's not a messing up with the low level of your system. It can straight mess up with your brain. Okay, what are the low-hanging fruit attacks that can be done? Like, how can they be prevented? Okay, this is a very local problem that can, but this expands to your definition of transhumanism and accessibility to the technology and what type of potential these technologies will give. And along with that, this is the positive side. We're assuming we're gonna expand our abilities, but there might be limitations of our abilities, and we need to be aware of that as well. And I would say this is what I would like, and I am partially already doing my team to focus on for Meta. And Meta is very sensitive to these ethical reasons because it's another passion of our CEO, even including the way we're going to use data in AR, which is another hot topic. And it's connected to that because what is the limitation of a deep learning algorithm that delivers, for example, some form of adaptive interface to the user? And how is that interacting with the user's ability to perform that skill naturally or whatever else? So we're really going into a huge department there that is showing us one point. We're talking about something that we have gone like 10-15% along the way. There's a lot to be discovered. There's a lot to be studied. There's a big need both in technology development, user studies and research, ethical, social, philosophical, and so forth. And it's all connected. There's nothing that is less important than.
And we haven't even touched biometric data yet, right? Like in terms of the implications of data analytics when it comes to personalized biometric data. And so I think that, yeah, it is on the CEOs and the researchers of the company to really be thinking ahead. Not just what do we have with the hardware today, but in 5 to 10 years, the level of fidelity that we have. Again, I keep pointing to this. The iPhone X has an eye tracker in it. And so the ethical question is not a question for the future, but it exists again today. Perhaps it's not as to the resolution that we would hope, but it exists today and the implications are already here.
Exactly. Look at the news. I mean, Facebook right now in 2018 faces this crisis about the data being misused. And I honestly have a feeling, looking at the talks that Mark Zuckerberg gave at the Congress in US, that he was similar to me believing in the good of technology, but he has a responsibility and I don't, being responsible for, you know, this technology to also not be misused in a way. And apparently he never thought about this data being misused, right? And speaking about biometrics and also augmented reality, I can only recommend everyone the book called Change Agent by Daniel Suresh, because it's a, you know, dystopian view where you have ads around you and also someone's genes are changed. It's a great book. So when you want to you know, elaborate more about the ethical possibilities, just check the book, Change Agent by Daniel Suarez.
Awesome. And before we end things, I want to recommend people to go and find your TEDx talk. It is called The Renaissance of the Third Dimension, correct? And you talk about the change of art going in Renaissance, going from flat perspective to real linear perspective, and how that is happening now to software and interfaces. And you talk a lot about how neuroscience has a big part in determining the design of augmented reality, about the opening of like the ventral dorsal or the dorsal stream itself, and how right now we've been stuck to the ventral, and how mirror neurons actually will play a big part. So if you like this podcast, I think you will like the TED talk that you gave.
Maybe a question from the developer or researcher perspective. So when someone is listening and he's a developer or researcher, first of all, how could he get information about your headset? How could he, you know, contact Meta about cooperation with institutes, or, you know, any questions that he or she might have, right? I guess I remember when I was a researcher and I was, you know, discovering all these new wonderful technologies and devices, I always didn't really know how to approach those startups or those companies. Is there a good way to do it? Or?
Yes, there's increasingly more ways. Now we have, for example, we have a Meta community, which is community.metavision.com. Which is a forum, our developers, but you don't have to be directly a developer, because this is where you gather information about the headset and you gather it from the community. There is an exchange of code and so forth. I would say this is one of the major go-to places for your question. By email directly, info@metavision.com. We have a customer success so-called department. For research questions, you can email me directly, s.baldassi@metavision.com. For the spelling, go look at the podcast website. And the website itself, is probably the one of the... We're going to revisit the website possibly soon, but information on the headsets are pretty much everywhere, and this is also where you can order the headset online. But even before buying, for any information, I can also be personally contacted. And for institutes, as you said, we're doing a lot of collaboration with institutes. The last one was like me going to KAIST, for example, and opening a channel with Namedzin Institute, actually, in Korea.
Nice. You're the first person to pronounce my name correct since 3 years. Thank you very much.
Very true. Thank you again, Stefano, for joining us. And thank you all for listening. If you like the podcast, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at ResearchVRCast. And if you want to help support the podcast, which is a free podcast, ad-free, and no sponsors, at least yet, you can find us on Patreon as well. And that would be incredible. Thank you for our 10 listeners that have been contributing there. And thank you again to Stefano for joining us.
Thank you, guys. That was very fun. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.